This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Six Democrats would like to be their party's nominee for Congress in the 6th District, currently represented by Republican Fred Upton. One of them is Matt Longjohn. He's a doctor from Portage, national health officer for the YMCA. Thank you very much for being here.
Oh, my pleasure. And I should say previous national health officer for the YMCA. No longer represent the Y in any capacity.
Noted. Thank you very much. First of all, tell us some more about yourself beyond that and why you're running for Congress.
Sure. Well, thanks again for having me. This is an exciting campaign with lots of folks in and trying to unseat Fred Upton and provide some resistance to the federal agenda that he's voting along with all the time. I grew up here in Portage. My dad was cleaning buildings when I was born, but ended up being a serial entrepreneur, helped found a number of businesses here in the Portage-Kalamazoo area, including Portage Commerce Bank, for example. My mom was a teacher in the Portage school systems, and our family's been here for 150, 160 years, farmers, Sunday school teachers, what have you, but never politicians. So I grew up in Portage schools, went to Kalamazoo College for my undergrad, and then got my medical degree at Tulane University. Did my internal medicine residency at Northwestern, and as a doc, was focused more on prevention than treatment. For my whole career, I've been using my public health degree to help people live their healthiest possible lives. I've had a lot of success with that nationwide, culminating with President Obama's team at the White House naming me one of the top 100 innovators in healthcare in America just 3 short weeks before the November 2016 election. After the election, of course, there were a lot of debates around healthcare policy and a number of other things that compelled me to get into the race and offer up a couple different alternatives.
Let's start there with that idea of prevention. I think that there's a lot of talk about how, of course, it's much better to prevent getting sick than to treat getting sick. But what are the things that you could do in public policy that would encourage prevention as opposed to simply treatment?
Yeah, we have to introduce health into all of our policies if we're going to ultimately bend the cost curve of healthcare. Whether it was the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare, or whether it was the Republican health care plan of last summer, which was introduced by Speaker Ryan and ultimately passed through the House by the Upton Amendment, they've all been focusing on the wrong things, in my opinion. Prevention is where we're going to need to invest to bend the cost curve. The healthcare cost curve. And the kinds of things that we can see in policy aren't just rejiggering our healthcare system to incentivize prevention and healthy behaviors, but also to include health in our transportation policy, in our agricultural policy, in our infrastructure policy, in our tax policy. We can include all these different levers as means to achieve healthier outcomes, which will save businesses a lot of money and help people live their healthiest possible lives, give kids better opportunities, and ultimately. Ultimately, that's one of the things that I want to bring to this race is a holistic understanding of what health can mean and how we can adapt our policies across the spectrum of policy to achieve those kinds of outcomes for people.
Give me a quick example of health related to transportation, how you would incorporate health in the idea of us getting from point A to point B.
Yeah, so transportation infrastructure often intermingle in people's minds because we think about roads and rails and things like that, right? Well, we need to make sure that our transportation infrastructure is intermodal, meaning that walkability, bikeability, are parts of our transportation infrastructure. We need to make sure that as we're building our built environment, our downtowns, our cityscapes, that we not only do that for health purposes, making our communities walkable, think about like the downtown mall in Kalamazoo, but it also provides economic benefit and outcome to design cities that way, design our transportation infrastructure that way. So I want to make sure that whether it's transportation enhancements, as we've seen in the past couple decades in policies like Safe-T or Safe-T-Lou or Ice-T, that we are promoting walkability and bikeability in our infrastructure. That's one example of how transportation policy can relate to physical activity and health. Other things are converting old rail lines that aren't used anymore into trail lines. Again, transportation in that case might abut and can get connected to environmental policy. But I bring this holistic view of health to make sure that no matter which of these sides of policy angles we're talking about, we can put health measures and outcomes into them.
You say on your website that healthcare is a human right. Does that mean that we should move to some sort of a single-payer system so that there's a mechanism, perhaps we pay taxes into it, and then basically people are able to get healthcare, be it preventative healthcare or healthcare treatment, if that's necessary, from a payer such as the government?
Well, as a physician, right, I would never want to turn anyone away for care that they need because of an inability to pay. That's an ethical position as a healthcare provider. It's the Hippocratic Oath, right? Thousands of years of physicians have signed on to that kind of tenet. I absolutely believe that healthcare is a human right and that everyone should have access to and be able to utilize affordable, high-quality healthcare. How we get to that point, there are lots of different paths. Who pays for all of it is a big debate. When people often talk about single-payer systems, sometimes they put up France's example, for example. But France covers the essential health benefits 100% and anything beyond that 70%. And then there's still an insurance market on top of that for reinsurance. So I think that we do need to guarantee essential health benefits are covered by insurance products. I believe that we should have a public option on the individual exchanges because especially when we talk about covering preventive services, there's not enough money in that, quite frankly, in our currently designed healthcare system for providers, hospitals, insurers to focus on the things that we know produce better health outcomes for people. We keep focusing on OR suites and various treatment facilities. But if we want to focus on prevention and help people live their healthiest lives, we've got to shift the whole market towards prevention. And I think government does play a key role in that. I think people will choose that over private insurance if we give people that choice on public exchanges. And I believe that that will lead us towards a situation where the government can have a guarantee for everyone that preventive services and essential health benefits are covered. Single payer for everything all the way to, elective procedures, et cetera, I don't believe that's in the cards.
What would be a sensible gun policy for the United States and one that would get Matt Longjohn's vote if he were a member of Congress today?
Yeah. So, again, I bring a holistic view to health. I don't believe you can live your healthiest possible life if you're at threat in your community or if you don't have the resources needed to prevent gun injury. And I've been working on this particular issue for about 18 years as a public health subject matter expert. I've published articles and done these kinds of radio interviews on gun injury prevention policy for nearly two decades. The way that I look at this is as a public health problem, that there is an epidemic. And just like if we're going to try and address smallpox or tuberculosis, that we need to approach the problem from a public health standpoint. What that means is starting with the data, figuring out from the data in the epidemic where we need to put our greatest priorities. So many people would be surprised to know that in this district and in the state of Michigan, the majority of gun deaths are actually from suicide and in rural areas. So we can't have a conversation about gun injury prevention in this district without making sure that older white rural farmers, for example, have a rural healthcare system and a mental healthcare system that can help intervene in a cycle of suicide and mental health depression. We also need community-based solutions to intervene in homicide. And that's something that plays out in different corners of our district differently than in the rural areas. But we also need policies to address mass casualties. So we need all of those different angles to come at the gun injury epidemic, and different approaches are going to be needed. I mentioned suicide prevention and mental health for rural areas, breaking the epidemic of violence by intervening in a cycle of violence for homicide, for assault weapons bans and bump stocks and things like that. Are the policies there, the red flag legislation, that's all trying to get into the cycle of mass casualties. But as a doctor, I've seen 13-year-olds come into emergency rooms and die in front of me. I've been on the back of ambulances going to multiple homicide sites. And as a public health person, I just believe too many people are dying too early. And we have to do all of those things to improve gun violence. Last point, Gordon, is that to fuel all of this, we need to fully fund something called the National Violent Death Reporting System. It would cost our country about $24 million for all 50 states to be able to merge data from the medical examiner's office or criminal justice systems and help us find those patterns that we can then intervene in to reduce gun injury and gun death in this community.
Specifically, though, in terms of who should have a gun, you mentioned the red flag legislation. Who are the people who you would say, if that red flag goes up, no, absolutely. They should not be able to get a gun, at least right now.
I think that folks with violent criminal histories, especially domestic abuse, should not be allowed to purchase guns without the whole universal background check, having the data system behind it to trigger reviews by court systems. That's where the red flag legislation comes in. And judges should be the ones to decide this, just like we decide in mental health cases who needs to be hospitalized or not. This should be part of our court system. But almost 85% of women who are shot, for example, are shot by someone who they love and probably who they live with. And so, when we look at the statistics, again, we need to have that kind of data system in place to help inform these policies. We can follow the path to the greatest possible success. In traffic injury in the 70s, people were dying at massive rates. And we created something called the Fatal Accident Reporting System that collects data on every traffic fatality. After 40 years of using that system, we have blood alcohol level limits, we have guardrails, we have airbags, we have seat belts, we have rumble strips. We can engineer our way into lower gun injury and lower gun death by using a public health approach.
I suppose one argument that someone's going to make from the other side of this is that there is no right in the Constitution to drive a car or to be a passenger in a car, but we do have the Second Amendment, which establishes the right to bear arms. And thanks to the Supreme Court, that includes the right of an individual to own a gun. Where do you think the government's right here, or where do you think the government's limits are on what they can regulate in terms of the Second Amendment?
The Heller case that you're talking about, 2008, gave individuals the right to own firearms, but it is untested as to what type of firearms. So I think that we're seeing court cases continue to proceed that will define this issue for a long time. But it's on some level common sense. Again, if we follow the data, and we know that states have opportunities to introduce policy like we saw in Florida after Parkland, that's where some of this gets tested. But having a federal data system, a federal public health approach, does not challenge the Second Amendment rights in the way that you mentioned them at the beginning. I'm a gun owner, right? My family passed down to me the duck guns, the hunting guns, right? Like, I'm not saying that we're going to be going after people's guns. But I think that if we follow the data and we follow the risk patterns, we can engineer our way into much lower rates of gun injury and gun death in this community, in this country, and we should do everything that we can. We've seen in the omnibus bill the repeal of the Dickey Amendment, which is one good step forward in the last couple weeks. We've seen states like Florida, Connecticut, Virginia, and municipalities all put forward policies that have helped. We need to follow the data and see where we can intervene in this epidemic, and it's going to be a long-term approach. I talked about traffic injury being a 40-year problem. That's truthfully where we are with this epidemic.
The Dickey Amendment was the one that prohibited money from being spent on researching gun deaths as a public health issue, basically.
Exactly. There was a federal policy that said that public health should have nothing to do with gun injury, gun death. And again, for 20 years, I've had a different position. I've said that doctors who see medicine as a social science need to react by seeing where the bodies basically stack up and intervening as part of improving our population's health. I've said that doctors should recognize gun injury as a particular clinical pathway. And if, for example, that woman comes into the emergency room with a gunshot wound, make sure that you ask, are you safe to go home? That's a clinical responsibility if we follow the data.
Let's talk a little bit about economic issues. On your website, you say that some of the trade agreements we have incentivize companies to actually leave the United States. So are tariffs one way to possibly address that?
Oh, well, what a timely topic today.
Sure.
The kind of back and forth that we've seen in the last couple weeks on tariffs, I think ultimately are going to hurt people, here in this district especially. This morning we're waking up to seeing news about 25% tariffs from China on soybeans.
Yeah, let me say we're recording on Wednesday. People may hear this later. So when you say this morning, it's Wednesday morning. So go ahead.
Yes, thanks for notice. People think I'm behind the times. Right. Or maybe 17 more things will happen between now and Monday. Right. Before that, obviously, it was steel and aluminum. That was the U.S. salvo. And actually, if you go before that, the first kind of potentially shot off the bow here was policy related to dishwashers and things that Whirlpool makes in this district, right? I believe that what we need to do in our trade policy is, we should not have fast-track authority. We need to have many people at the table negotiating our trade policies. B, We need to make sure that international labor has a seat at some of these discussions. As I said about healthcare, I believe healthcare is a human right. I think we need to put human rights in our trade agreements. That way, if there are situations where there's a rush to the bottom of the pay scale, we can have our shared measures be about human rights and quality of life. And if we put those kinds of measures into our trade agreements, then I believe that it would be harder to get down to the minimal, token amounts of pay that people get, or you see the labor camps and the sweatshops being created in countries that are driving labor out of this country, that we would be able to go back to those countries and say, sorry, you're not living up to these human rights as part of this trade agreement. So we now have another lever to pull in pulling trade agreements back, renegotiating. But whether it's NAFTA, CAFTA, et cetera, we do need to be renegotiating these things to put people first. But I think that the way that President Trump and Congressman Upton, who's been going along with it, have been moving, does not put people first.
On the broader issue of how to address stagnant wages, what does the United States do for people who feel like they've been working an awfully long time, not getting a raise or getting raises that really don't keep up with the cost of living?
Yeah. Since Congressman Upton's been in office in 1986, wages in this district have been flat to even depressed, real wages, inflation-adjusted wages. The cost of health care, the cost of education is clearly going up faster than the cost than the wages that people earn. And if you especially look at it in, for example, independent farmers, right? The subsidy program is keeping prices low. We've seen a 50% reduction in corn prices, a 33% reduction in soy prices in the last 3 years. This is before the tariffs take hold. Everyone, whether we're talking rural parts of this district or urban parts of this district, are having a harder time making ends meet. And whether it's a livable wage where benefits can also be attached to a minimum wage to give us a standard of living that we all need to get through the day, or whether it's by readjusting our tax policy to make sure that individuals are put in front of big corporations and we revolt in some ways against this theory of trickle-down economics. I believe that we can make a number of adjustments to help people get through the day, meet their basic needs. And we've just had the wrong focus for 30, 40 years when we put policies forward that are based on trickle-down theory. We've seen that those largest corporations, the most wealthy among us, don't give either charitably or in the form of contracted benefits back to individuals what people ultimately need to make it through the day and prepare for retirement. Give their kids opportunities, not just for four-year degrees, but for quality of life in vocational training and other kinds of career planning services. That's why we're seeing kids leave this district. So we have to focus on individuals and families, and that's actually been something that's been going the wrong direction for a long time. So just like health in all policies, we need to put people first in all of our policies. And the last part of this I would say is that connected through all of this is money in politics. If you follow where the money has come from, you can see why we've ended up in the policies that we have for tax, in the tax bill, or in our overarching economic policy. We aren't putting people first, and campaign finance has to be part of what we adjust.
Well, what exactly would you do about campaign finance? What, Citizens United, in favor of repealing that?
Absolutely. But it's not a question of repealing it. That's a Supreme Court decision, right? So ultimately, if we had to go all the way to some kind of constitutional amendment or something
like
that.
Which is the other way, right?
I've actually taken a pledge that if all else fails, right, that's what we will need to do. But there's a number of things that we can do to make campaign finance transparent. And that should be the standard. We should be able to see who all is contributing to whom. 100% transparency in our system should be expected. If we're going to hold our politicians accountable, and I would very much like to be held accountable to that kind of standard. That's why I took a pledge that no corporate PAC money will go into my campaign. It's all individual support. But if we're going to hold people accountable, we need to follow the money. I think that if you look at places like Seattle or other places around the country, that New York State, that have, again, innovated to create different kinds of campaign finance systems, there's some really great models out there to make our government more representative. In Seattle, for example, people are mailed out, taxpayers are mailed out vouchers, small dollar vouchers, I can't remember if it's $10, $25, something like that. And they get a book of them, essentially. And they can give those vouchers to candidates in their district. And then through the tax system, those vouchers are matched. So low-dollar contributions become more valuable to politicians, and they aren't just chasing those $5,000 checks like Mr. Upton has been doing. He's now up to something like 80% of his campaign contributions, 85%, from broadcast groups like Sinclair or the NRA or et cetera. And you can kind of follow where that money leads him into votes. And I think that we should make sure that, A, all of that's transparent, and, B, we put small-dollar donors and people first.
You have, though, raised a lot of money for your campaign, quite a bit for a congressional candidate, especially one in a district that, you know, has been held by Republicans for a long time. How have you done that if you have not had to take, if you're not taking PAC money? And should just that sheer dollar amount worry people?
Yeah, well, I'm proud of the support we've received from across the country, not just here in the district. As I said, for 20 years, you know, for my whole life, I would have passed a polygraph test as of February 14th of 2017. I had never thought about running for office. This is not what I've done. I've not spent 10, 15, 20 years building up political favors or anything like that. But the individuals, and it's all individuals from across the country who've supported my campaign, are doing so for a couple of reasons. One, they know my record. You know, I led a team that was the first team in the history of the United States to demonstrate that a community jobs program could save lives and save Medicare billions of dollars. Again, that's why the White House in 2016, named my team one of the top 100 innovators in healthcare in America. I've worked on gun injury prevention for 20 years. I've worked on transportation policy to help make cities like Chicago more intermodal and to make physical activity and healthy behaviors easier choices for people to make. I've worked coast to coast on that. As the National Health Officer at the YMCA, I helped lead 253 community coalitions that produced over 39,000 changes in their communities all over the country that ultimately impacted 73 million lives. So people have seen the results of my career over 20 years, and then they were also very aware of what Mr. Upton did last summer on the healthcare debate. You know, he did two things last May. He said first he would never vote for Speaker Ryan's plan, and then he did. That was his second thing. Between what I've done in my career and what Mr. Upton did last May, we've set up one of the what PBS News has described as one of the three most important healthcare campaigns in the country. This is one of the places where the battle lines in public health and healthcare policy will be drawn in 2018 because of my record and because of Fred's, and that's why people are supporting this campaign and this district from across the country.
Yeah, you noted across the country. Actually, at least according to the latest reports, more than half of your money has come from outside of Michigan, which means, of course, it's coming from outside of the district. You know, I guess I'm wondering, you know, why would donors support a candidate who will not represent them in Congress, assuming he's elected?
Again, it's what you know, my friends and colleagues and leaders of healthcare systems and employees of charitable organizations like YMCAs or groups like Meals on Wheels and other organizations that are benefiting from the policy solutions that I helped create in Washington, focused on prevention, see in my record. But these, if I couldn't raise money from folks who know me best, who I've been working with for 20 years, then people in this district shouldn't support me. But these are people from across the country. You know, I've spoken, for example, at the NASCAR Hall of Fame on public health issues. I've been across the country working on public health issues for 20 years. And people see in my record something that they want to support. I also feel like it's important for me as a newcomer in politics here to have been focused on building relationships with people in this district and not having that been purely transactional. So I've been depending on individuals across the country who know me best to put this campaign forward in a great way. And now we're seeing more and more local support. We have hundreds of volunteers and community citizen endorsers on our website. You know, we've put over 15,000 miles on the car meeting people across the district. But it's taken time because that's not what I was focused on for the last 20 years.
Okay. What happened February 14th, 2017?
I was speaking at the National Academy of Medicine, this is an institution that President Lincoln established to really have academic debates about the best way to practice medicine. There's also the National Academy of Engineering, and it's all part of the National Academy of Sciences. a couple weeks before I was there, maybe a week or so before I was there, I was speaking on cancer control and on the best way for our healthcare system to help cancer survivors live their healthiest possible lives. And we had just done a study on how YMCAs could help cancer survivors in their journey towards healthier lives. We had 55,000 cancer survivors in one of my programs that I helped lead across the country in WISE called the Live Strong at the YMCA program. And we were presenting the data from that at the National Academy of Medicine. But a week or two before that, President Trump had said, while sitting on the edge of a golf cart drinking a big gulp, that he didn't believe that physical activity was good for you. And as the National Health Officer of the YMCA, I thought it was important to say that actually, no, the science is clear. Physical activity is good for you, and we should not be telling people to be inactive. Long story short, I found that because of some fear in D.C. about making a statement like physical activity is good for you, that not just the Y, but charities all over the Beltway were so concerned about what would be taken away for kids in Head Start or who need summer food programs or individuals who are part of English as second language programs, that charities were at that point in time so nervous about what President Trump and the administration would do to their funding that would help kids and families all across the country, that I was asked not to say that physical activity is good for you. And at that point, I called the 1-800 number for the Democratic Party, and I said, I don't know what to do. I want to say this important thing, but I don't have a voice. And that started a conversation where ultimately folks encouraged me to think about running, showed me the data to show that this district was winnable. I came home, I talked to Paul Clements, and he encouraged me to run as well.
It's kind of ironic, but go ahead.
No, Paul and I are good friends. Okay. I would like to think that that's the case. We have the same
goal. But you're
now
competing for the Democratic nomination in this district.
We have different theories about what it will take to win, but we both want the same thing. You know, my family was supportive and all of that, but it was on that day, February 14th, Valentine's Day 2017, that I had made that first introduction to myself to the Democratic Party. And ultimately, that resulted in me deciding to leave my 20-year career in running against Fred.
So you say the data shows that this is a winnable district. I have to tell you, I've been covering races in this district for a long time, and I've been hearing that for a while. You know, if you're a Democrat out there right now and you're thinking about who you want to support in August in order to win in November, and assuming you look at the candidates and you think that you can live with any of them on the issues, what's the case that Matt Longjohn is the guy that is going to end the long streak of Republican control in the 6th Congressional District?
You know, if you look at presidential results, this is clearly a swing district. You know, Bush, Clinton, Bush, Obama, Trump, back and forth and back and forth and back and forth at the presidential election level. Congressman Upton has been here, obviously, firmly implanted that whole time. And that's what makes the appearance, I think, of this being such a Republican race or district. But if you look at the data, and especially in this kind of wave election where folks like Connor Lamb are winning despite President Trump winning that district by 20 points less than just over a year ago, we can see that this is a district that's typically called an R+4 district. So out of 100 voters, there might be 52 Republicans, 48 Dems. So, you know, that kind of margin is something that can be overcome. And I believe that if it's my longstanding family history in this district, 150, 160 years of family history all over this district. My dad had 47 first cousins in this district. People fondly remember Long John Flowers and, you know, things like that. Whether it's that longstanding tie to the district, whether it's the fact that we have the resources to compete, which you mentioned, we've been very successful in raising money from across the country, whether it's because of my record of outcomes that juxtaposes so clearly against Fred's in key issues that people care about, or whether it's the fact that we have been working across all six counties now for 8 months to generate the kind of citizen support that we have, or because of the professional team that I've put around myself for this campaign, including folks who've run 7 successful campaigns in the past, et cetera. We have kind of a constellation of things behind this campaign that I believe makes us the most electable. We can provide the sharpest possible contrast with Fred out of anyone in the field, based on results that I have demonstrated across the country in the coalitions that I've built and the teams that I've led.
Matt Longjohn, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Matt Longjohn is a physician from Portage and one of 6 candidates running for the Democratic nomination in Southwest Michigan's 6th Congressional District. The winner of the August primary will face Republican Congressman Fred Upton in the fall. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.